so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, earlier this month, wildfires consumed acres and acres in Monroe and Juneau County after Governor Tony Evers declared a state of emergency because of dry conditions. So we'll talk about that a little bit with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman with me right now. John Martin will be joining us. John is a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve, vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW. He's also, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So we'll also talk about some major flooding. We got fire, we got water, we got a little of everything here. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. What's the weather like in your area? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Looking forward to the summer.
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm going to go off script for a minute here because I, to my consternation, discovered this morning that last night there was a Northern Lights display.
I missed it too.
Oh, you missed it. I was just gonna complain to you that you didn't call me and tell me that it was.
No, that's one of my rules, right? If you see when you should call me, and you know, I missed the. I usually have a thing on my phone to get sun activity, so that I get to go look at it. But I didn't get anything. I didn't look out the window, and then on Facebook, I saw people publishing things that they took at like 11:30 at night or something.
I was long asleep by that time.
But I was still up. That's what I should have thought.
Well, let's talk about fire. It turns out the past winter was Wisconsin's wettest meteorological winter on record. Heavy rainfall late February, for sure, that helped us beat that record. So we had wetter winter here.
Yeah, that was such a weird time because they were issuing, the National Weather Service was issuing red flag warnings, which basically are saying don't light fires. And it seemed so weird because we were such a wet winter. Also, the soil was really wet. But the key to remember about fires is it takes fuel. And to get fuel to burn, it doesn't matter how wet the ground is, you need to dry out the vegetation. And during that time, we had really warm weather, low humidity, and strong winds. And those are the things that dry out the plants, particularly since they hadn't leafed out yet either. So it was a really big danger for the potential for wildfires. And we had some, as you pointed out.
Yeah, but it did seem counterintuitive.
It seemed right, yeah. And I wanted, Ann and I had collected, my wife and I had collected a bunch of, wood to burn in our fire pit. And it was piled up, and I was just like, I want to burn this, but I knew better than to do that.
That red flag, what triggers a red flag?
Yeah, they look at the wind condition and the humidity, I think, are the primary drivers. And then there's another one that I don't really understand, so I won't try and talk about it. those are the two primary things. As you might expect, low humidity means things are going to be dry. Wind means it's going to spread. The primary thing, what that tells you is not that the conditions are ripe and that you shouldn't do burning. So it's a real warning type system, telling people what not to do.
David Duluth had emailed us. He asked the greenhouse gases are measured in parts per million. How much does the removal of nitrogen affect this?
You're not putting in carbon dioxide or methane or any other greenhouse gas and taking out nitrogen, which is the most popular gas in our atmosphere.
Yeah.
So that's not changing unless fertilizers may change and may make some, or if you're pulling some out intentionally to make nitrogen and separate out the oxygen. But yeah, it's not like we're replacing one gas for another
okay.
in terms of molecules.
And Roger emailed us, and he wonders, why does the Earth's atmosphere simply not just fly off into outer space? Could we create an atmosphere around the moon or another planet?
I think our atmosphere is generally, or on any planet, is probably trying to make its way out to space, but we have gravity, right, which is what's going to keep the atmosphere tied to our planet. The idea of putting an atmosphere, I mean, they have, you know, science fiction looks at, you know, adding atmospheres to like Mars, you know, which does has an atmosphere, mostly carbon dioxide and very thin because a lot of those gases had already escaped. I think the amount of energy that would require even to put an atmosphere on the moon, which is a relatively small planetary or not planetary object, space object, would probably require a lot of energy. We're probably not seeing it in our lifetime.
No, for sure. Yeah. Well, let's talk about flooding for a minute. Because that wet winter is also the reason the National Weather Service says the Mississippi and could reach its highest flood level in 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. And part of that was associated with the record snowfalls we had. This meteorological winter, which is December, January, and February, was the most snowfall that we've had in Madison. And that occurred through a lot of the state as well. When that melts, that's going to go into the river, but it's also going to go into the soil. And all of that moisture in the soil also heads downhill and so feeds into the rivers as well and increases the water levels. And I think you're seeing it in the Madison Lakes as well now. The lake levels are creeping up.
And I'm guessing that they're probably creeping up pretty much everywhere in the state. I mean, there was record
snowfall everywhere.
Yeah, Duluth was, I forget how, they broke the record for the most snowfall they ever had in at least recorded history.
And then we had some heavy rain events earlier in April, and that's going to contribute to the flooding as well, or rising river levels.
Do we know, how do scientists predict? I imagine there are some ways to predict the flood levels. I remember years back, a soil scientist, Art Peterson, had a string of cemetery officials and funeral directors around the state looking at frost depth.
Oh,
and
right.
And he was quite good at predicting the amount of flooding based on what he was getting from those folks.
Yeah, that's another aspect of it that I hadn't thought of. When you look at frost depth, that means the ground's frozen. So if it rains on that ground, it's not seeping in, right? It's just running off the ground. And so I think hydrologists are really good at predicting that in terms of they know what the water basins are. And so they can have point measurements of how much is there at any given time and look at what the transport is from one area to another. I think I would guess probably the hardest part for them to predict is associated with the meteorological aspect of it.
Yeah, that would be for sure. He was, Art Peterson was really pretty darn good at it. And I think some of it is the amount of snowfall that is on the ground before it really gets cold.
Right, yep. So if you get down the snowfall on the ground before you really get a deep frost in the ground or frozen ground, it's going to act as a blanket, right? And it'll keep it from warming. And so throughout the winter, as long as the snow stays there. So it is pretty complex. And that's why I guess they really need those measurements. And cemeteries are a good place to make those measurements because, unfortunately, they're digging a lot of holes every day.
Well, just along with that, I'm reminded of there's a song, I think, and there's certainly a little poem about April showers.
Bring May flowers.
Bring May flowers. And we're almost to May. We soon will be. But April, and you guys, I think, even wrote about this in your newspaper column about April. Yeah. Why? What's the deal with April showers?
So it's associated with instability. I mean, when you get showers, that's kind of it's not like the big thunderstorms you get in the summertime. It's like the precipitation we had last week, I think, where it's real spotty, and it rains really hard, and then it's not, and then it looks sunny, and then it rains again. And a part of that has to do with the stability in the atmosphere. So we get warmer temperatures near the ground, but up high, a mile above us, it's still relatively cool. And so there is a general, or cold, so there's a general instability where that warm air is trying to move upward, and that generates cloud cover and precipitation.
And so, and April is probably the perfect...
April and March are the perfect months for that. Yeah, yeah. And then May, things, you know, start settling down as the entire atmosphere begins to warm up, not just down near the ground.
So we were talking, another area that I wanted to talk about was pollution and air pollution. Let's talk about that for a minute. And pollution, I guess there's a pretty broad definition for what that is.
Yeah, and, you know, if we focus on outdoor pollution, because there is actually measurements of indoor pollution as well, there's a couple of ways we look at it. One is associated with gases, you know, so one can consider carbon dioxide as a pollution because it's coming out of human processes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is to look at particulates, so things that would come out of, again, heating plants, fires that we might do, lawnmowers, anything that generates a smoke is sort of like a particulate. You can think of it that way. And we measure those routinely. The environmental agency routinely has spots in a variety of different places along highways, out in fields that actually measure those. The ones that I think are most dangerous to humans are what are called PM particle measurements, 2.5, so they're like 2.5 millimeters, which means you can breathe them in and they get to your lungs. And so that's an important one to measure.
You know what I don't hear as much about is acid rain.
Yeah, you don't. That used to really be a really big thing. And part of that is when we put up regulations that would prevent a pollution into the atmosphere, you can clean it up. And that's pretty much what we did with acid rain. That used to be a really big problem in the Northeast. And they controlled pollution measurements, and that kept acids to getting into the rainfall and acidifying the rainfall. So instead of being neutral on a pH scale, it was more acidic.
And so, yeah, I can't remember. I mean, there were movies made of...
I remember when I was growing up, and it was day, and you could see it when you would go. I mean, obviously, I grew up in New York. And so you could, you know, see the impact in the forests that were happening. But, again, I think we should look at that as a positive thing, right? When we see things that we're doing that is not good to the environment, we can change what we do and ameliorate those situations.
Well, I tell you what, Steve, we've got lots more to talk about here, but we're going to take a little break for the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences as well. John Martin will be joining us. He's finished up his class, and I'm sure he's hurrying over to join us for the last half hour, because Steve's going to stay with us and John Martin will be joining us in just a couple of minutes right after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Weather guys are back with us today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Well, at least one of our weather guys. Steve Ackerman's here, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. John Martin is coming from class, so he's probably a couple minutes late, but he'll be wandering in here pretty quickly, I'm pretty sure. He's former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW and Madison, and I'm pretty sure he will make it here. So we've talked about quite a few things with Steve to begin with. Air quality was one thing. What's the air quality like in your area, or how do you think we should get rid of air pollution? Maybe you could share some comments on that. But maybe you just have a general question about the weather, something you've always wanted to know about, or maybe about the field of meteorology. You can call in no matter what at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Al in Green Bay wanted to know, he says he went out west to see the northern lights. They appeared to his naked eye as white, but his camera shows them as green, and he's wondering, why the heck is that the case?
That's really interesting, because I would think, like the northern lights we just had the other day, those who I talked to who went out said it was really faint, and they got a really good pictures when they did a, 2 second, 5 second exposure, and then it looks really good. But I would think we tend to not see color when it's really intense, right? And then and then all our separate wavelengths associated with color get all mixed together when we see white. So I'm not sure why in a not a very intense, unless again maybe our rods and cones just can't pick up the color when it also is really a faint color. As well.
It's that one. That's a tough one for sure. Yeah. Peter emailed us, as the ocean levels rise, do elevation measurements of mountains and so forth shrink? Sea level is measured by barometers, correct? He wants to know.
Yeah, so sea levels are measured. The sea level atmospheric pressure is measured by barometers. And so sea level globally would be measured by relative heights at different places along the shorelines, as well as from satellites. So you can use lasers to measure ocean heights now as well. Land heights, I'm not sure about this, so we'll have a, probably have a geographer correct me, but I think the heights of mountains and things are measured by some standard average height of land across the earth, not relative to the particular space that they're at. Now, the other thing is we talk about changes in the height due to sea level. You know, once the glaciers and on Antarctica and Greenland are all gone, and they're melting pretty quickly, relatively to geological timeframes, I guess, the land that they're holding down is all going to pop up. So they're sitting on land, and that's a lot of weight. And so as those Arctic sea ice on Greenland in particular and in Antarctica melt away, that altitude of those land masses beneath them are also going to surface up.
So they're probably they may be rising incrementally right now.
Right now, right. And it would be hard to measure what those are.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dean in Colorado has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Hey, I love your show, by the way. And I want to say we can pat ourselves back on the back, I think, a bit with reduction in acid rain, as you mentioned earlier, and ozone, or at least being aware of that. Seems like we're getting on top of it. And I imagine greenhouse gases are going to be a lot tougher nut to crack because of the money involved and the amount of infrastructure, I suppose. But one thing in the realm of pollution, I was wondering if you consider heat one of those, and our change of the albedo, or again, I guess getting back to color, surface change on the earth. And then off of that topic, my son just sailed up from Guatemala to Houston and saw a lot of sargassum in the upper Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico. And I was wondering if that change in albedo was perhaps accelerating sea surface temperatures.
Ooh, that's a good question. I would think not in terms of sea surface temperatures. And the reason why I say that is that when you have those plants form on the surface, they're going to reflect energy back out into the atmosphere and keep it from penetrating deeply into the water. And so that would almost maybe lead more to a cooling. Otherwise, you're right, on the terms of the albedo change of the planet, we do measure that, and we've been measuring that pretty accurately since the 80s when we have satellites up there to do that. Whether or not we're seeing a change in that might be hard to tell. I don't know the answer to that. And the reason why I say might be hard to tell is because clearly as the snowpack changes and reduces, which it obviously is, that's going to make the planet darker, so lower the planet albedo. But whether or not we could detect it on a global scale might be hard just because of the variability on where the snow is occurring and what replaces the snow. So you can imagine if it's soil, then that's going to have a higher albedo in general than, you know, a dark forest or other kind of plant vegetation.
Yeah, and somebody's already asking, what's albedo?
So albedo is the amount of energy that's reflected back out into space. So it's the brightness of an object, and we usually think about it in planets. So there's an energy balance between how much sun energy is hitting the planet and what percentage of that gets reflected back out to space, and that's what albedo is, that ratio.
Dean, thank you very much for calling. You know, in his comments, his other comments about successes.
Yeah.
We were talking acid rain, and then he also mentioned ozone.
Right, the Montreal Protocol. You know, there was a lot of talk. This was back in the 70s now, I think, right, where we were seeing depletion of the ozone layer. And the issue for that, particularly for human health, was that meant more ultraviolet radiation from the sun was getting down to Earth, and that causes skin cancer. And so there was things to keep the ozone from being destroyed by other chemical processes. And so that again, is another example where we were able to successfully interfere with what we're doing in the human activities and have a positive impact. And also on air quality, you know, the amount, as we were talking before, particles in the atmosphere. You know, we've had a lot of pollution controls now, which has made the air cleaner.
Yeah. Dean, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Here's one. I'm not sure if you're going to... Well, you might. Tom in Fox Point wonders, do you know of any guided or docent-led viewing of the 2024 solar eclipse in the Midwest, or where to look for this?
I know there's a big solar eclipse in 2023, so it's coming... 2024. It's coming next year.
Yeah, next year. 2024.
Yeah, and it's pretty well described now. So if you search on the web, it's going to tell you where that path is. And so I know I'm already looking where I'm going to go. And I highly recommend that people do that. And it's really cutting across a big swath. And so I would recommend going away from a city, you know, open space so you can see the horizon. I've gone and seen two total solar eclipses now, one in Montana in the 80s and then the more recent one in Wyoming. And having that flatness is an experience because you can actually, in both those cases, we were in open plains and you could actually see the terminator, which is the shadow from the sun, racing towards you. So I would look for the Mississippi Valley area or the far southwest, someplace where there's a lot of openness to really experience it.
Yeah, and you need to keep your eye on the weather forecast, too.
And you also need to keep your eye on the weather forecaster. Yes, forecasting. So get a good weather forecaster with you. I happen to have a pretty good one at the time. Yeah, and start thinking about, that's a good point. You really want to start thinking about where to go, what the options are, and then as you get closer and closer, really pay attention to where the weather is because it'll be depressing if you get there and it's cloudy.
Yeah, and you maybe need to be mobile a bit.
And you need to, I would recommend being mobile. So that's why I'm saying have options of where you're going to go.
So Pam in Sister Bay, she's another question. I'm not sure you're going to answer this or not, but she uses a fireplace insert to heat her home in the winter. So she heats it with wood. Is wood burning preferable to using electric heat in terms of pollution?
Boy, that's a really good question. So when you when you're burning wood in the fireplace, you're going to be generating particles that are going to go up the chimney. So you're doing it locally. When you do it on electric heat, then you're, any pollution that's being generated is going to be from the electric company and wherever they're doing their work. I would guess, and this is where I guess, that you're generating more pollution if you're heating your home from a fireplace, only because there's no regulations on it.
Yeah.
Whereas the other place is going to have regulations.
And it's for sure down the road here, there's going to be a lot more heating done electrically
yeah.
because of wind power, solar power, and a lot of
right.
Things like that are going to, I imagine, going to make a huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
Well, you can join in, too, 800-642-1234. You could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. John and Boaz will go to you next. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a science question for you.
Okay.
You're scientists. The best method of generating electricity for energy in the future, it'd be burning wood, because Wisconsin has 80,000 acres, and if we could get 100 trees per acre, we would have enough BTUs to provide 5,000 kilowatts for every house in Wisconsin.
So I would, I'm gonna change the conversation, because he has an argument there. The downside of that argument is how long it takes to grow a tree, right? So you're going to cut one down, you're going to need many years to grow another one. Having said that, there is a lot of research looking at biofuels. And so switchgrass, an example, which grows really quickly. So there's a lot of research looking at how do you use plants to do bioenergy resources. In fact, the Wisconsin Energy Institute, you've probably had Tim on the show, has talked about that.
Many a time, actually. Yeah.
And so I think that that is a future, but I don't think it's associated with trees, just because, for one thing, it takes too long to grow them in terms of what our energy consumption is.
Hmm. John, thanks. Al in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I have a question. Your guest mentioned the term meteorological winter, and I've heard this now for a few years. I'm just curious about when they started using that term, meteorological winter or meteorological summer, and how they came about with deciding what months to include, because they say meteorological summer is June, July, and August, but I feel like it's really July, August, and September. So just curious.
Yeah,
that's a really good question. And it's funny how we have been really distinct in using that phrase now. And it's been around for a really long time. And I think it primarily comes from, there are four seasons in a year. Of course, that's not true for every place on the globe, right? Some places are only one or two seasons. And so you just divide up the 12 months into four and you get 3 months. And so that's why we call that the meteorological winter, January for us, for the Northern Hemisphere, December, January, and February, and then mix it up. You know, and it's important in terms of doing statistics, because by doing that, then everybody's doing the same statistics no matter where you live. If you really try to define winter or summer locally, then everybody's doing different averaging time periods, and that's not good for a statistical analysis.
Yeah, that makes sense. Al, thanks for calling. Mark in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. Last summer, I was vacationing in northern Door County on the eastern shore, or on the Lake Michigan shore. Really hot day, very calm water. It was too cold a water to go into. It was below 50 degrees. It's in July. It's still 50 degrees. So I built a little thing to put my feet into to keep them cool. And over a long period of time, I realized that there was this really long period wave that was coming in that crested at about 15 to 17 minutes from crest to crest with a height above 4 inches. And I was wondering, what causes that kind of a long period wave out on the lake?
Wow, that is a really good question. I'll take a guess at it. And because I'm an atmospheric scientist, I would put it in terms of some kind of a weather event was going on that would cause that kind of oscillation. Because I don't think you're gonna get that from the circulation in the Great Lake. I could see you getting it with tides in the ocean. But not in a lake.
And it could be something quite a ways away.
Could be something right. Yeah. I mean, my first thing was that, well, it could be shipping. But if you're observing it over an amount of time, then I would think that the waves that are generated by the shipping would eventually just
dissipate.
And so you would need a big, large-scale forcing to keep that moving.
Hmm. There you go, Mark. Thank you for calling. Gary in the town of Ween, we go to you next. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Love the show. My wife and I were outside working, listening to the show, and we're cleaning up branches and trees that went down in the ice storm in December, and the lower ones to the ground are still frozen in by chunks of ice. And as we're out there working, it started snowing, and then the snow turned to sleet, and we decided to come in for lunch. But that's how it is up where we're at.
Wait, is that today, or was that over the weekend?
That was like 5 minutes ago. We said, that's enough. The sleet just kept coming down, and...
And Gary, what's the you're in the town of Ween? Give us
what else is around?
Well, we're 6 miles from the exact center of the northern half of the Western Hemisphere, which is by Ponetusky.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're in north central Wisconsin.
Yeah,
Madison County.
Oh, wow. Well, Gary, I'm glad you are where you are,
and I'm glad I'm living where it's a little warmer because. By the time we get to this time of the year, I'm ready for winter to be over.
Yeah, I imagine you are. Gary, thanks a lot for that report, though.
You know, I asked if it was happening now or over the weekend, because we had grapple, you know, which is like soft hail, over the weekend as well. So
it was quite a mixture, actually.
It was quite a mixture, right?
Snow, a little rain, grapple.
Yep, and then it would get sunny, and then you'd get some more. Yeah, it was interesting weather.
It was quite an Earth Day weekend.
Good day to stay home and work on a paper, which is what I did.
Oh, man. Thank you, Gary. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up. A previous caller brought up meteorological seasons, and I just want to express a little bit of a pet peeve with all due respect to your guest, who is very informative. I have no problem with meteorologists saying meteorological seasons, and because it's useful to them. But I think that's the thin end of the wedge, and pretty soon they drop meteorological and just start referring to the first through the actual astronomical seasons as winter or summer. I know one of the local TV newscasters last year said, where was all this rain back in the fall? And that was December 15th, which is still fall. And I just want to point out that, you know, humans have tracked the movements of the planets and the actual seasons for thousands of years. It's something that we have evolved with. And it is precise down to the second, whereas meteorological seasons, I would I would have a hard time believing that it's anything but somewhat arbitrary, because there's not that much difference between the 1st of December or the 30th of November or the 2nd of December. So,
Actually, you have a good point, and I'm thinking back to the caller that asked that question, and I went to the answer of, well, we've always been doing that, but we've never really, until recently, been saying that verbally or in our newspaper articles or whatever. So I'll stop saying it. I'll just keep calling it winter, right? Spring is here and summer's coming. And what else do we care if it's the first or the end of the month?
Oh, good man. We had another question about UW research about evaporation. Anything going on in that area in the last 30 seconds here?
I'm sure there are people looking at it. And when I think of evaporation, I think of Over Lakes, which certainly there's a lot of work going there because we have a great luminology department. And I also imagine in the agricultural area, they're looking at how fast things evaporate.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we are out of time. Steve, thanks so much.
It's great being here.
We'll have to talk to
John with me next time.
We'll find out what happened to John. I'm sure he's okay.
I have to.
Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. He'll be back probably with John Martin on the last Monday of May. Oh, a month away.
Meteorological spring.
Thank you very much for listening. Tomorrow, by the way, Bill Stork's back, a veterinarian, to answer your pet health questions. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.